Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
FM. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster. I'm in studio with Stefan Hostetter and Sabina Hasseni. Oh, I'm getting thumbs. I'm getting really good at remembering how to say people's last names at the last minute. We have an interesting show for you today. We're going to be talking, of course, about Trump a little bit. Not so much him, though, about things inspired by him. So in a moment, we're going to go to Stefan, who did a last-minute call-out. If you're a good reason to follow both Green Majority and Stefan's Twitter, which is at Green Majority and at Stayho underscore.
Yes.
For stuff about the show, and there was a last-minute call-out last night for ideas of ways to resist or things that we're going to do now that we have to deal with the reality that is Trump. So Stefan's going to take point on that and just discuss some of the ideas, because you got a number of people sending you in ideas as well. So we're going to be talking about that in just a minute. In the middle of the show, I have a couple of news items we're going to run through. There's a bunch of things that I thought was really important this week, so that I'll just tell you now, we simply do not have time to get to all of them. A great reason to check out the show post, though, however, I'm going to sort of allude to a few of them and hope that you go to the show post and read these articles. They're not long, but they're things I think are worth knowing. But I picked out two that I think are not necessarily even the most important, but the two things that I think are most useful to talk about. And then at the end of the program, we have an interview. We're going to be joined by Dugald Mosley, who is the filmmaker behind the latest Nature of Things documentary with David Suzuki on the CBC Doc channel, called The Secrets of Our Senses, from the Myth or Science series. We've spoken to Dr. Jennifer Gardy, who's the host of the show, before. She was unable to join us today, so we have the filmmaker instead, which is equally cool. And one of the reasons, as I've said repeatedly, that I like talking to documentary filmmakers so much is that they're people who, generally speaking, don't know anything about a topic until they get an insane crash course on it. And I find their viewpoint on that topic to be extremely illuminating, because they're both speaking from a position of at least some authority, because they've done quite a bit of research, but they also didn't have the background. And so they have this unique ability to sort of discuss things that surprise them. They have a unique ability to take sort of the every person's view, right? So we're going to be talking to them. Now, the documentary, of course, as you probably alluded from the name of the film, is about sort of the science of the senses. The angle we're going to be taking with that interview, though, is about sort of truth and this whole ongoing issue now that is the quote-unquote, and because I don't want to use it in the same way that it's commonly used, the idea of fake news. And more importantly, just how do we know what's real so that we can make important decisions, make wise decisions on these important issues. And then we'll probably carry some of the Trump stuff into the bonus show, as well as, I'm sure, some griping about Trudeau. But that is the show we're going to be listening to. I'm going to take no more of Stefan's time, however. Please take it away.
Thank you. So I think it should be noted, and I think it's interesting, that we have an oddly distinct honor, because by listening to us, you are therefore not able to watch Trump walk on stage and be introduced.
Nice.
So if you're listening to us live, we are now talking over the great talker over of humanity.
Wrong.
That is Donald Trump.
Wrong.
Because he's actually finding himself the idea was he's actually – there's been multiple protests. So I'm actually curious to find out later if it's been slowed down in a way. But he was supposed to be introduced at 11.
Yeah. For those of you who can't see inside the studio right now, I'm actually leering creepily behind Stefan as he's talking.
Yeah. It's making it much more difficult to have this piece. So Donald Trump is being inaugurated as historically unpopular. The latest Fox News poll has been 37% approval, compared to when Obama got approved in 2008, 80% approval. So this is I think he may be the first person ever to be inaugurated less liked than liked.
He's number one at sucking.
Yeah, exactly. He's really nailing that. And there are protests across the world. And if you want to Twitter is super interesting right now because there's all the people are finding all these interesting ways to resist.
I'm sorry, I can quantify that actually with a very, very interesting number. A lot of people don't know this. So an interesting way to judge how many people, because it's historically very difficult to judge crowds, right? Even if people say they're coming because weather and all this, and people like to say when they're not and they come when they don't. So a really good indicator of like how many people are coming are requests for bus permits. There have been 398 requests for bus permits for today to actually take part, sort of like charter buses, getting people from out of state to come in. 398 buses have requested charter permits to park their buses for today. Guess how many are for the Women's March tomorrow?
I believe it was 2,000?
1,200.
Ah.
But for three times.
Yeah.
Triple the amount of people. And that's 1,200 buses.
Right.
There's going to be somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people protesting tomorrow, and probably less than 300,000 actually attending today.
Wow. So this is an interesting time, basically. And so what I wanted to do, as you sort of teased earlier, was last week I had a unique opportunity to sit in to the Agents of Change Climate Solutions pitches for the Center for Social Innovation where we both work, It was almost like the best solve, I feel like. The best way to sort of experience this time, because listening to these 40 amazing ideas, which were whittled down to 21, was this amazing, like, look at all the actual really cool things that are happening. And so I think what I'll do in future episodes is come back to this and sort of talk about it. But if you want to learn more about that, check out February 7th at Google Agents of Change Climate Solutions launch party. We're going to have a whole thing on February 7th on the show post itself and come and see these people because like they are part of this resistance. But what I also did was I made a call out last night in the wee hours of the morning. So I think it's impressive alone the number of people who actually reached out with such value and interest to provide these ideas.
To be fair, I think a lot of people were having trouble sleeping.
Fair enough. And so I want to go through sort of a whole host of ways and ideas of different types of resistance. And what I find interesting is that this comes from each in different angles too, which I find really, really also interesting. And so the first one was to keep a weekly journal of things that have happened, because the news and the facts are going to be heavily disputed. You know, as you're wrong earlier indicated, you know, that Donald Trump will deny anything, all facts, basically. And so it's easy to start doubting our own reactions and our own internal narrative of issues that we care about. Essentially, duplicating a more or less objective record of current events to the point where the truth can't be obliterated or lost in balanced coverage. Balanced was with air quotes, but you can't see them because this is radio. And it also serves the value of this again is like, you know, create your own not create your own reality, but like justify your own, like make a record of reality. So when someone tells you something didn't happen, you're like, you can go back and be like, no, it did happen. And it also serves as a record to show how not normal these things are, right? If each time you're surprised by something, you write it down, then the 15th time it happens, you can go back and remember the first time it happened and how surprised you were. And so that's resistance number one. Resistance number two is be specific about the problem. So not getting lost in sort of hating all of America, but the rather venal, nihilistic, and racist wings of the Republican Party that undermine American governance. You know, it's important to remember that, you know, he won with about 26% of registered voters and only 37% of polled Americans approve of him. This is not representative of the entire entity, and therefore – We must remain specific, because as soon as you start demonizing all of America, you have your ability to resist is hindered, because you're losing that 75% or 63% of people who could be on your side by lumping them into this piece. The third is to not allow again to a second person being like, do not allow them to be normalized. While resisting the urge to reject everything he does out of hand, and this might be a controversial one, but I think it's at least worth mentioning that you know, we if we are going to be, you know, the last 8 years, the Democrats spent this entire time, you know, slamming the Republicans for saying no on everything. You know, Obama was quoted once of saying, I could read line by line the Republican National Convention's platform and they would still be rejected by a Republican Congress. And so I think it's important to try to take the still, even in these times, try to, you know, if something as good is happening, let, you know, don't fight the good.
Well, just on that point, I think it's really important to point out we don't need to theorize that. And I mean, Obama's an amazing speaker, and he was very clever with his language. But we don't need the joke. Hmm. The Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, is a Republican idea that he took literally.
Yeah,
literally. That
Mitt
was
Romney
their
passed it in Massachusetts.
That was their opposition when the Democrats were talking about single payer.
Hmm.
And that was their idea. And then they literally adopted it. And now Trump has been, in, to some degree, elected to remove it because it's an evil Democrat socialism idea.
Except that he's also said that he's going to provide basically a single payer, which is perhaps the funniest thing. I don't actually think he'll do it. But anyways. So that was resistance number four, and this idea of, you know, does a high road still exist? We don't know. But, you know, we can only hold ourselves to our own standards, not to his.
And only because they just added Back to the Future on Netflix last week, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Aha. We need spaceships and moon bases. The next one, so rejection number five, is this person's going to spend more time reconnecting with what we're building. On top of more donations and volunteering with grassroots organizations, more deliberate self-caring, and more deliberate remembering of what the world could and should look like. So, you know, this came up a couple times, the sort of reinvestment in the positive. Patton Oswalt has a whole thing about how instead of watching the inauguration today, you should go and support a local theater company or a restaurant near you that's struggling, and sort of to invest in your local community and invest in the pieces of the building blocks of the world we want to see, rather than just fighting and tearing down the pieces that you don't. Next person suggests with resistance number six, with meditation, I can consciously rewire. They reference an exchange between doctors Gabor Mate and Alan Kalpin, clued me into the potential of anger. When we're enraged, the tightening of a voice and shallow breathing and muscle tension. Must be listening to this show. Imagine we've experienced our signs of anxiety, not anger. Kaplan describes this as acting out anger. And while those who psychologically experience it, he actually observes relaxation. I swing to acting out, which gives me less command in a conflict. I don't know yet my processes dismantle this behavior, but I do know that I am... But I do know that I am now realizing my potential as a frontline worker because I've replaced empathy and lack of boundaries with compassion. So this exchange is possible, and going through it will make me more effective as an activist. And I think this can't be underscored. The number of times that I've found myself, you know, responding in anger, to only realize later that that's not actually the most effective response. It almost never is. More often than not, if you can give yourself the half second to breathe and then respond a second later, your second response is going to be more effective in almost every way, and especially in the act of resistance. Resistance number eight, don't ever say we did not give a bunch of things you can do. Giving money to ethics and public interest watchdogs like Public Citizen, as well as U.S. Planned Parenthood and the ACLU nationwide is one of the best ways to resist. If you can swing it, I personally give it to Public Citizen, and they do amazing and important work. Like, these are as a person who sort of exists in a company that sort of is, you know, maybe not actually. I see a lot of organizations that are these advocacy organizations, and the amount of which a little bit of money can actually, you know, these organizations are so much smaller than you imagine them to be. You know, they are 2-3 people, but they are working just ridiculous hours.
Well, it's like what happens with our show. I've talked about it on the show, but we've talked off air repeatedly about how. I'll occasionally get an angry email from a listener or from an interview potential because, you know, it took me more than 24 hours to respond to them. And it became clear through the conversation, it's because they think this is our full-time job. And I was telling somebody at work the other day how complimented I am when somebody gets mad at that, because the idea that we're doing such a good job that they're confusing enthusiastic volunteers with slacker employee. I literally reply to people and be like, hey, we're volunteers, and I really appreciate that confusion because you just gave me the biggest possible compliment. But that is like, we're not the odd one out here. This is standard. And Stefan and I are authorities on this, particularly Stefan, because his job is actually to work with these organizations. I just, you know, make the food for the cafe. But we also know people there. Like, this isn't like one or two examples. This is the majority of these organizations. There are a few big guys and thousands of small organizations that like $50 will like make or break their next campaign.
Oh yeah, and it's mind-boggling the scale at which the campaign outshines the number of people working on it. Yeah. You know, it's just, you see some of these organizations and you're like, how, like, you look behind the curtain and you're like, you're two people and one computer, and you just, but you understand the power of networks, and so any little bit amount of money these organizations can go so far. Yeah. Resistance number nine is by focusing on the actual issues that need to be discussed. The sale of news is a business. I can think critically and logically about the media machine about what the media machine is spinning. By being pro-choice, by standing up for human rights, and by not subscribing to terror politics or allowing it to change the positive ways I behave. Now, of course, we've discussed this a lot. I think what's interesting to see is what the media does during the Trump presidency. There have been signs, there have been some positive signs, but there's some negative signs. You know, the fact that Trump was given credit for Congress backing down on the ethics piece is a very bad sign. Because what happened was a mass movement of people called every one of their congressional districts and stopped it. What did not happen is Trump tweeted and the Congress changed their minds. Right. Like, this is, and yet the story that preyed on the media more often than not was the fact that, you know, that this was happening.
Or the carrier deal, which right. He literally just paid the company to keep their jobs here.
And not even a lot of jobs, and tipped his hand too early. Like, the number of ways that it's just, yeah.
His badness is overshadowed, or his ineffectiveness is only overshadowed by the ineffectiveness of the media covering him.
Right.
You mentioned one positive sign, which was, we don't have a live internet connection here in the studio, or at least I don't. So I don't have time to look. I don't have a way to look it up right now on the fly. But there was actually I meant to flag it. There was an announcement last night from some journalism like industry group. Basically, they were saying it as if they were all locked in arms on this. I'm anticipating that this was more hopeful, because obviously they didn't go around and talk to every journalist, but they essentially, it was a declaration that their members would be locked arm in arm, and that there's a commitment that if a journalist was shut down, that the next journalist would forego their question and repeat the question that wasn't asked until they get an answer. Now, I'm skeptical that this will happen, because I don't have that much faith in the corporate media, but it's a positive sign that people are thinking that, because that is an effective way to resist. Yeah. So if they do manage to do that, or if a large enough group of them manage to do that, that could end up being really effective.
Yeah. Okay. So we're down to, I have three more. The next one is that basically don't watch the inauguration. To some extent, you are already doing that because you're listening to the show, unless you have your simulcasting.
Well, if they're watching it on mute while listening to us, I feel like that's okay.
Fair enough. I think the point that this person's making is to not give him the ratings that he wants, because of course everything for Trump is about ratings.
Right.
I'd be really funny, I think, if The Apprentice got better ratings than the inauguration. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think that would just be personally very funny to me. That would be number 10, I believe. People can correct me wrong if my numbers are now off, but I think that was 10. 11 was texted into me at the last second, which is that I will resist Trump first in my very being by representing in every act not his antithesis but his antidote. Second, by understanding the history of American governance and finding and listening to those best able to articulate his madness. And third, by being prepared to physically intervene where necessary.
From the choice of words alone, that was your brother.
That was my brother, yeah.
Yep.
Of course it was. and also the ability to text me during the show. Two particular things. So all of you can follow me on Twitter to get some access. Other ways is you have my exact number because I live with you. And the last one, so that was 11. And I think you know, I think he brings up a couple different points of understanding the history that Trump exists in is monumentally important. I think, you know, I think Obama's election allowed a lot of America to believe that they lived in a post-racial society, which was already stupid, but it allowed people to say that a bunch of times. And I think the Trump election is sort of the America being like, no, no, we were always like this. And so I think it's important to note the fact that, you know, Trump can slam someone who marched with Martin Luther King on Martin Luther King weekend, and everyone just sort of, you know, carries on, is testament to the problem. And the final one comes a friend of the show who responded. So the way I asked the question was actually not specifically how you resist Donald Trump, but how you would resist the small-handed orange one. And so the last one comes from a good friend of the show, Rob Shirky, who says, to complement the complementary color or opposing color neutralizes. For example, if you have too much orange, add a little blue. So a nice makeup tip, if you find your life a little too orange, add a little blue.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, there you go. I think that was suggestion number 12 of ways to resist Trump is add a little blue.
All right. Well, at the beginning of the next section, I have two things not to do that I'm going to add before I get into my news items, but we should go to break. So you're listening to The Green Majority if you just tuned in our special reality isn't real, facts are not facts, antidote show, I guess. And we'll be back to talk about some news and my quick two tips on things that I encourage you to consider not doing as ineffective or perhaps most likely
counterfactual?
Not counterfactual. It will do the opposite of your intention.
Counterproductive.
Counterproductive things that people, I feel, are going to be tempted to do, but I will urge you not to do. I'll do that after the break. First, we're going to go to Megan, who is our tech this week, who's going to tell us what our first music break is. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to do some of our more focused news coverage here, but really quickly before we get to that as well, I just wanted to add two things that I encourage people not to do. They may be tempted to do to resist Trump's, but they will produce the opposite effect. They will not be accurate. They will not be effective, and I encourage you to actively resist doing them, despite the temptation that may exist. Number one, I think is obvious, but I feel the need to remind people anyway. Violence, and I don't even necessarily mean violence in the sake of, like, you know, some sort of terroristic act, but even, like, you know, violent protesting, I think even, like, screaming at his supporters, these are all giving oxygen to people that that are basically like Trump, a lot of his most fervent supporters, the ones you're most likely going to be confronting, and I'm talking mostly obviously to our American listeners here, love that. They love the fact that you hate them. And so resist that and go ahead, by all means, peacefully protest, do anything you want. But sinking down to the hate level, hate doesn't beget hate. And it will simply fuel it. And not only is it not effective, in this particular situation, these people love the fact, particularly Trump loves the fact that some people hate him because he just wants the attention. So don't do that. You know, by all means, protest and do everything else. And most importantly, like think about it, like whether he's been popular or you know, whether it was something he said that was popular or not popular, accurate or not accurate, Trump just gets off on having his name said, and he gets off on having his name on the front of news articles and headlines and people talking about him. That's why he's going so nuts that because he knows that like basically nobody is showing up for his inauguration today. So I think this is a lesson we can carry through, which is that he will do anything for people's attention. So if the majority of Americans, which it appears, oppose him now, he's at popularity 7, I think you said 44 earlier, I've heard numbers as low as 37. A lot of people are splitting the difference and saying his approval is around 40% right now. I think that will only continue to go down over the next 2 weeks as people see what he's actually, because I think there's a percentage of people that are just like, okay, hold on, give him a chance still. And I think that number will continue to go down. So I think the way that I would encourage people to do it was obviously don't tune out. Focus on him, but don't make it about Trump. Go after his cabinet picks. Go after the senators. Go after specific policies and talk about the policies and just say this administration. Do everything you can to not say his name. It will make him insane. And aside from just the joyful pleasure of knowing that you're driving a hideous person nuts, I think this is actually a way to force him into better ideas, because at that point he'll do anything to get talked about. And I think he's so desperate for attention. I think, and he's already demonstrated this, but when the healthcare thing came up, is that he's essentially promising stuff more liberal than what even the Democrats were offering. Meanwhile, while his actual health minister and cabinet picks are going, yeah, I'm not sure. We're probably not going to do that, because he's just saying whatever he needs to say to get people's attention. And I think this is actually a way to exert force over Trump. So don't say his name, fight him, but leave his name out of it. That's how you'll get his attention. That's how you get some power back. The second thing was that I wanted to comment, and I won't say the person's name, but I was having a brief phone Facebook conversation with somebody who was posting around an app that blocked out Trump-related news from your newsfeed. And I commented on it and saying, you know, I would like to respectfully disagree, because I think that this is exactly what he wants you to do. He wants people to get so frustrated with facts and so frustrated with the conversation and everything gets so overheated that people just tune out. This is how people like him get power, by getting all his opposition to basically give up and tune out and go play video games or whatever, and just completely tune out of the system. I understand if you're somebody, and you know, we were having a conversation here during the break about, you know, we totally understand if you feel like you're overwhelmed and you need a break, totally do that. If this is coming from a point of view of the fact that you need to take five, and that might mean 5 minutes, 5 weeks, 5 months, do the thing. Do you. Take care of yourself. But don't, and this was the thing that irritated me about the response I got to that comment, which was, you know, I'm going to tune out, and the way I'm going to help is by, you know, thinking positively and spreading positivity in the world. That's not helpful. So if you're going to tune out, what I would encourage you to do, and obviously this is limited by people's ability to do so, but I mean, as I said, do what you feel like you need to do, but don't think you're doing anything positive by tuning out. And if you do need to tune out, totally respect that. Consider making a donation instead. Buy permission to do that, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're someone who's just, you're overwhelmed and you can't do it, and you can afford to make a donation to any of these groups supporting the Women's March on Washington or anything else, please consider doing that. But just don't fool yourself into thinking that that you're helping just by, you know, trying to, you know, limit your world to your own little world and thinking that if you're a good person, that'll go far. Sorry, we're hippie on this show, but not quite that hippie. So there's that. So the thing I really wanted to talk about news related was, there was a really interesting thing that happened, and this was also all over social media as well recently, which was Trump, Freudian slip now, Trudeau made comments about phasing out the oil sands, and he did this during his cross-country tour. By the way, if you want to stop by CIUT and answer some of my questions, please feel free. The invitation is open, Mr. Trudeau. But he made a comment which surprised many, including me, saying that inevitably, eventually, we need to phase out the oil sands. Now, he's completely right. But there's two things I wanted to talk about here. One, which was, he continues to be an absolute clown about how to moderate public opinion. And this is something that is a serious problem for Trudeau. He is horrifyingly bad at messaging. He thinks he's good at messaging, which is part of the problem, because he thought, well, I won such an overwhelming vote, so I must be a great messenger. No, that was a rejecting Harper vote, and we need to remind him of that. He's really, really bad at making his case. He just seemed like the most viable and likely to be elected alternative, which isn't even an endorsement of him. That's more of an endorsement of the liberals are the most viable alternative to the conservatives. I don't think that has anything to do with whatsoever about Trudeau, other than the fact that he doesn't seem particularly offensive to your average Canadian. So there's two things here. One, I want to talk about the comical response from the Wild Rose Party. The other thing is I want to make a comment about why this is super bad messaging. So first, let's talk about the Wild Rose response. So Wild Rose leader Brian Jean told the CBC, I'm sick and tired of people attacking our oil sands. I would truly suggest that Mr. Trudeau keep his comments to himself when he doesn't know what he's talking about. Irony. We certainly don't need an out-of-touch federal politician sounding like Jane Fonda, which is just... it's so silly. So the point here is that Justin Trudeau is absolutely right, and this Wild Rose politician is a fool. The reason is because, of course, we have to. First of all, it's going to be phased out just by simply running out of the resource. For starters, on a politically neutral point of view, we have to plan to phase it out, even if that's 85 years from now.
Yeah, that's the statement itself, taken at with any sort of understanding of time scale, is meaningless without a time scale attached to it. You know, it's like exactly. It phasing out is like saying, yeah, the words only matter for the time scale he's talking about, and he wasn't really clear about the time scale, so it's a very innocuous statement.
Yeah. Now, the second thing I really loved was PC Leadership candidate Jason Kenney asked Trudeau if he would rather, quote, hand over all global oil production to Saudi Arabia or Iran or Qatar. I got news for you, Jason Kenney. Saudi Arabia is investing $1 trillion in renewable energy, you jackass. Like, these people are just so completely out to lunch as to what the actual reality is that they don't realize that anyone who's actually has any information on this topic, how completely cartoonish they sound. The problem is that, like with the Trump problem, a lot of Canadians are not educated. So please share this program with your friends. So that's just completely comical, because referencing Saudi Arabia is probably the biggest argument for, as we've said repeatedly on this program before, is the best possible argument to make for that, because they have no interest in investing money in things. They don't have to please their voters. It's a dictatorship, essentially. It's a plutocracy, essentially, because the princes are also rich and essentially exert control. And they've done that through a partnership with, yes, some pretty hideous religious groups. Let us not forget that I think 12 of the 14 hijackers on 9/11 were all Saudi Arabians, right? So, which is not to necessarily or in any way imply the country, but it is a particularly religiously zealotous type country. So yes, we shouldn't, we should not be necessarily get too close to Saudi Arabia, but they also have zero reasons to do things for anything other than their own economic benefit. And they're probably one of the biggest investors in renewable energy. And I'm saying probably because I don't know. So if somebody emails me saying this country is whatever, you know what I mean? The point remains, they're making massive investments in renewable energy. I think that's an excellent argument. So here's the point about why. So that's why the response was silly. Now, why did I say that Justin Trudeau is terrible at messaging? Well, because if he was going to make this argument, why you would do it at some random town hall in Alberta with a bunch of people who are obviously going to be the most resistant to that message, as opposed to, during the youth conference where he instead scolded people for putting out messages about how they need to phase out the oil sands, and then scorns them for not being willing to have a conversation, and then turns around 2 months later and comes and says it to a bunch of basically, down-home Alberta folks that want to know what's going to happen with my future, and says it to them out of context. Terrible politician. Secondly, if this was really what you were thinking, maybe he's just been listening to the show. That's possible. He might have been listening, and he might have gotten that this is the type of language you need to be spreading if you want to actually if you want to gain back some of the support that you've lost with all the folks who are concerned about climate change, then maybe this was the right way to do. Still, this was not the venue to do it in. The timing and place was any of the other times when he's scolded or run away from, instead of, scolding or running away from any of his climate change critics, that maybe those are the people he should have said it to and said, look, I agree, we need to phase out the oil sands, and I'm gonna come up with a plan to do it. That would have been the time and the place to do it. So he's just a terrible politician. But that's the more important part. you would never say that unless you had a plan. Why would you think that you could ever say that without a plan? So now we on this program have discussed a plan, and it's I have quite a detailed plan, in fact, not detailed as in I've run the numbers, but detailed conceptually, a framework for a plan. A framework for a plan about how to move forwards on this. But you have to say what the plan is. So even aside from saying, you know, the timeline, politicians hate committing to timelines. So I understand why he didn't say it. But he could have said, you know, over the next generation. Mm-hmm. That would have been vague enough because that could mean 10 years. That could be 80 years, right? But the most important thing isn't even the timeline. The most important thing is the plan. What are you going to do? Because every single thing here, if you read all the responses from the crowd and if you read all the responses, they're saying, hey, you're selling out my future. You don't care about... the leader of one of the intern leader PC thing he said is he needs a political SPAC. Trudeau threw Alberta under the bus today, and Notley is sitting on her hands playing powder cape and blah 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 blah. The point is that they're right, though they're not right in that they're factually incorrect, but they are right in the sense that that was a stupid thing to say, because if you're going to phase something out, yes, our economy is largely dependent on this industry. Tons of people are – it is in many senses an economic driver for the entire country. And so if you don't have a plan about what to replace it with, you are being an idiot. And I'm the first one to say so. But here's the thing. You've had lots of time to come up with a plan, and you need to have a plan. So I encourage the Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau, if you're listening, or if anybody as part of the Liberal Party has any access to Trudeau, say, look, we love this, but you're going to get slaughtered politically if you don't come up with a plan. And you know what else too? The environmentalists aren't going to believe you unless you come up with a plan. So please keep to this messaging, but do some homework first. If you need some ideas, call me. But you need to have a plan. Now, my plan, just so people don't think I'm blowing hot air here, is that we need to have a mass. Instead of all this money we're going to invest in pipelines, maybe let's invest all this money in job retraining. Because as we've said repeatedly on this program, and as you can easily look up on the internet yourself, and probably most people can intuit just naturally, is that many of the skills that people are learning or have learned or need to use in the oil sands are directly transferable to renewable energy, right? Geothermal and pipeline digging, a lot of transferable skills. Digging oil wells and digging geothermal, Emily, also lots of transferable skills. Electronics, engineers, welders, all these skills are directly transferable to the green energy revolution. So if you say, look, we're going to put all this money aside, we're going to spend on oil infrastructure, we're going to create a gigantic job retraining program and create a bunch of policies that not just incentivize, but in many cases force. So for instance, you can't build a new building that doesn't at least generate 20% of its own power or meets, you know, either or. You can either supplement it by building in its own renewable energy so that it's not pulling off the grid, or you can beat this extremely forward-thinking energy standard, right? So give them a couple options about how to do it, but just say you cannot build buildings in Canada unless it meets the standard. You've now created you haven't picked the winners because you've created a bunch of options, people to make their own, just like with a lot of these carbon plans. You've given people the freedom to figure out how to solve the problem. You've just given them a benchmark for here's what we expect, come up with your own way to solve it. And now you've just generated a giant demand for what? People that can build, they can install energy efficiency and all sorts of renewable energy. And now you're taking all the people who's concerned about their jobs and you're giving them other jobs. Now, this is going to cost a lot of money, but guess what? So is cleaning up oil spills, so is building oil infrastructure. These are the things you can be saying. Now, these numbers have to be run, obviously. I'm not thinking that my high in the pie, you know, ideas here that I'm just spouting off, they're not off the top of my head, but I mean, for the sake of argument, you could say they're off the top of my head. But he needs to think about it. He's the one now that's claiming that his policies are gonna deal with climate change. And now he's even apparently so courageous that he's willing to go to Alberta and say that we need to phase out the oil sands, despite the fact that it's obviously true. But you have to come up with a plan. So please, Justin, we love what you're saying. But nobody's going to believe – first of all, half the people are not going to believe you because you haven't even given one hint of a plan about how to actually do that, or you're saying it at some so distant time in the future when it's politically irrelevant for you. And everyone, as you saw from this response, who depends on the oil sands, when you don't offer them an alternative, are going to think that you're threatened. So this is a political loser, and I'm concerned that what happens is that he doesn't learn his lesson. He doesn't come up with a plan, but he keeps using these talking points and then gets slaughtered by – you know, terrifyingly, it might be Michael Chong, who's conservative, who's running for leadership, who actually wants to implement a conservative idea of a carbon tax. But we could also get somebody like O'Leary or Leach. And that is terrifying, and I don't think we need any other reminder about the dangers of that other than what's going on south of us right now. Now, that went a little bit longer than I wanted, so I'm just going to really quickly just say what the other news article is. You can look it up, and I'll just read a couple of the titles. There really isn't a lot to say about this other article, but it was something just sort of like a warning here. There, a woman died in the U.S. After an infection from bacteria-resistant drugs. Now, drug-resistant bacteria, got that backwards, is not a new thing. What is new, though, is that this woman died after they attempted to use all 26 FDA-approved antibiotics. This is not just resistant to a antibiotic, to every single thing in the arsenal. This is extremely concerning. This creates the possibility of a it's been quite some time since new antibiotics have been discovered, very few over the last few decades. So we have to consider, in addition to a Trump era and a post-truth era, that we aim also maybe that we may have Trump while we move into a post-antibiotic era. And that should be pretty concerning. So a couple of the other news articles I encourage you to look up on the website. There's a great clip, which I want you to listen to, called Russian Reporter Get Ready for Trump at Trump's Authoritarian Press Conferences, about a Russian journalist talking about how they, over the last 18 years, have had to – what they learned about dealing with Putin. And he's basically giving a warning. Hey, here's what happened with Putin. This is what you're going to expect over the next few years. It's extremely interesting. Definitely check that out. Also, Supreme Court rules fracking critics. A fracking critic doesn't have charter right to sue. Some talk about how the Koch brothers are playing politic by, you know, essentially pretending to shut stuff down because of climate policy, but then doing stuff that makes it pretty conclusive that that's not what's actually going on, and they're just trying to influence Canadian politics. We have cross-country hearings going on with the NEB modernization. I'd love to talk about that more. We may come back to that next week because that's also kind of goofy. Companies increasing energy storage, and the NEB assigns recused Energy East panel member to the new TransCanada-owned file. I should note that we always have some stuff from the National Observer here, but a good half of these articles are from the National Observer as well, so big up to them for continuing to do a great job. You'll find all those links and more on the website. But that's it for now. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk about the secrets of our senses with documentary filmmaker Dugald Mosley and the film The Secrets of Our Senses, which is an upcoming CBC documentary. But we are, however, going to take another quick music break here first, so please take it away.
Up next, we have Reflector by Arcade Fire.
Some more.
And we are back, and this is the tail section now of the Green Majority. You're listening on CIUT 89.5, or possibly one of our wonderful and very appreciated radio partners across Canada, now into the U.S. as well, and our international listeners through the podcast, as well as folks who may be seeing us on one of our other partners. We got stuff posted at rabble.ca, National Observer, more to come as well. And we'll have some, we have a whole bunch of cool interviews coming up and whatnot. So stay tuned to greenmajority.ca for details on all that, or hey, just listen, download the podcast, do whatever you need to do. Very important, especially now. We're going to take the last section now, though, to talk to Dugald Mosley, who's the filmmaker behind the newest CBC Nature of Things documentary with David Suzuki, Myth or Science, The Secrets of Our Senses. Are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for taking some time to join us today.
No problem.
If I can, sorry, if I can just get his mic a little higher. I don't know if we can do that there. Cool. All right, now we can hear you now.
Okay, good.
So one of the things that I was very interested about this, because obviously our listeners will recognize that there isn't a super obvious direct link to the environment from this. So the reason that I wanted to talk about this was we've had obviously with we're now live during in 5 minutes or so we're going to have the killer of truth elected in the U.S.
and Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, so just when I saw the description, I was sort of at first, I was thinking, because a dear friend of mine who works for the CBC frequently sends these for us. And I was like, I love doing the CBC docs, but I'm not really sure the connection. But then it hit me that the importance here, I think, is almost the inverse. And that was, so it made me think of a quote, and I think that's where I'd like to start, which was, I dug it up before the show, which is attributed to Confucius, but it's, real knowledge is to know the extent of one's ignorance. And I thought really the theme here, we're talking about things you learned about how the brain works and how our senses work, is that to understand that gives us a very important ability to know what our limitations are, and yeah, and essentially to make this a giant pitch for empirical science and how we shouldn't necessarily, trust our own instincts. So I'd like it if you would just start about, what did you learn about the benefits, but also the limitations of our ability to sense things accurately.
Well, I think it's a very good point, and the whole fake news issue that's been raised as a result of what Trump's been about. What struck me the most, and I think it struck our host Jennifer Gardy as well, is that really we think of our senses as being these super reliable things. We look out at the world, we listen to something, that information goes to a certain part of our brain, it's translated, and we see or we hear. And what we discovered in this documentary is actually you can't really rely very much on your senses. They aren't nearly as accurate as we all thought.
And one of the things that came up for me too is, of course, in a courtroom, witness testimony is considered, fairly high on the list, but in a science context, it's basically next to meaningless. There was a famous clip by Neil deGrasse Tyson where he said if somebody came up to him and said, I saw this thing, he'd say, great, go test that and come back, and yeah, then I'll be interested,
Yes. Well, it's true. I mean, we one of the people that we talked to was a doctor named Gustav Kuhn, pardon me, who's in at Goldsmith University in London. And basically, he's not only a psychologist, but he's a magician, because he believes that the kind of tricks that magicians have learned over the last 1,000 years are basically tricks that use the kind of failures of our brain or the limits of our brain to realize exactly how our senses function. And so we basically visited with Dr. Kuhn, and he ran Jen through a number of different situations where it was very clear that she was taking in only a very small portion of what she was seeing out there in the world. He did a couple of card tricks on her. She didn't notice what had happened. It's basically partly because of our brain's need to basically take in an immense amount of information. And, if it had to take all that information in, run it through the brain, and then tell our body what to do, for example, we'd have to have this massive brain far bigger than our head or our neck to hold up. And as a result, our brain operates with some predictions. It uses what's called our internal model, which we build up over a lifetime of experiences. So, for example, if we see a ball thrown in the air, we expect that ball to come down. That's something we just got used to over time. So our brain, rather than watch that whole action, it immediately decides, ball's going up, ball comes down. So it makes that decision, it has our body respond to that, whether that happens or not. So this whole need for the brain to make predictions in order to be able to function means that a lot of the information that we get visually we might not be totally correct, or we might be missing something that's out there. And to all of us, that was a bit of a shock.
And so one of the other things that I found sounded really interesting was the UCLA Multisensory Perception Lab, which just sounds like a place I'd go on like for a weekend trip, but I'm a huge dork. So, the idea about tricking the senses with relation to, was it tactile? Was it a rubber band and a fork and whatnot?
It's a very bizarre place, and it's a very bizarre kind of process. The context is that scientists who work in the area of the senses realize that what they have to do in order to understand how our senses function is trick our senses so that we can see how they can be tricked, which reveals how they work. So the idea with the rubber hand illusion is that you sit someone down at a desk, you put one arm behind the screen, and you replace that arm with a rubber hand. So when you look down, because you're blindfolded at first, when you look down, what you see is your left arm, for example, and your right arm now is replaced by a rubber hand and a rubber arm. And so the person conducting the test on you, and Jen Gardy went through this as well, they stroke your hidden arm and the rubber hand at the same time. So it feels like your real arm is being stroked, but what you're looking at is actually the rubber hand. And what happens is that the body, the brain, again, has to take in the information it's receiving both from its vision and from its touch and decide which information to accept. And what ends up happening is that in the test, they pull a fork out from under the table, and unbeknownst to the person who's having their hand stroked, they stab the rubber hand. And the reaction, 100%, almost 100% of the time, is the person screams because they think they've been stabbed. And, Jen, who sat there and watched this illusion probably a dozen times and then sat down and had it done to her, she screamed like crazy as well because she thought she'd been stabbed. So, again, it's the brain having to take in this information that it's receiving. It's getting different sensory data, and it has to decide which it's going to accept. So in this case, it's accepted by looking down that rubber hand belongs to the body. And, it's a neat thing because the brain does this. It's constantly, as Ladan Sham said to us, the head of the multi-perceptionary lab, she said, you would think that the brain would know what the body is. It's part of that body for your entire life. You would think it would know what's your hand and what's not your hand. But she says the brain is constantly calculating its sense of self. And the reason this is really amazing is that, for example, if you're a hockey player, you can make that hockey stick part of your body if you use it enough. Mm-hmm. Your brain starts to accept that the hockey stick is an extension of your hand, which is why we see these hockey players who can do amazing things with their hockey stick that we think we could do. That's part of what was revealed to her through this whole
Well, that makes me think of, and this may not be a perfect comparison, but it makes me think of that thing we've heard about, the 10,000 hours thing, where if you do something for 10,000 hours, you become proficient. Well. And the part of that is simply is that if you're doing, maybe this doesn't apply to some areas, but at least in the areas of physical activity, that this is sort of the amount of time it takes the brain to just sort of include that in the sense of self.
I think that's probably very true. I mean, they talk about it with, concert pianists who, it's amazing what somebody can do on the piano. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that your brain starts to change its sense of self, and that allows us to function in an extraordinary way. But it is counterintuitive. You would think that we know. We lived in our bodies for X number of years. We would know what is part of our body and what is not. But the brain is constantly calculating that every second of every day.
And I briefly, when I was younger, had for just like 1 year, I had a motorcycle, and I've never really had a lot of luck learning how to drive a car. And for me, it was because I found it very easy, as somebody that grew up from a very, very young age mountain biking, I find it very easy to put my sort of sense of self around a bike because it's sort of small and over the center. And so I'm quite agile on a bike, but being able to extend it in a lopsided way to such to account for the sort of offset position of the driving a car, I've never been able to drive a car. The one time I took a driver's test, I failed before I even got out of the parking space. It made me think of that as well, as being like just sort of expanding your mind over an object when you use it enough. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And maybe that's what it comes down to. You just need to practice more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also biased against cars. So that's fine. one of the other things that made me come up, though, with coming back to the multisensory lab as well, is it made me think of this this talk. I forget who it was by. It was by some other famous scientist in the U.S., but I watch a lot of YouTube lectures and stuff. And they were talking about how the brain is biased towards false positives as opposed to false negatives, because at a very basic sort of reptilian level, if you think there's a threat and you're wrong, you live. And if you think there's not a threat and there is, you're dead. And so over millions of years, we've essentially evolved a bias towards false positives. And I think that's very much what the rubber hand experiment was showing, was it's safer to assume that's your hand and have a fear response or a defense response than to assume it's not.
Yeah, better safe than sorry.
Right. Yeah. And then that whole mythos. But the of course, what we've seen is that this is people, I think, aren't particularly aware of this natural bias towards false positives, and assume that their instincts are correct, which they can be, but they don't sort of take this pre-existing bias into account. I think that's where we get a lot of people believing in things that have long ago been proven false by science.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I mean, I don't know if this is totally connected, but we did have another experience in this process where we were looking at our sense of smell. And, the scientists in Germany, what they were interested in working out was they believed that early in our evolution, we actually could smell danger. Mm. We had that ability because we needed to have that ability to survive. And that over time, we've lost that ability, or have we, because perhaps it's not as required. Sure, you need to smell rotten food so you don't eat it and become sick and things like that. But they're talking at a much more subliminal level. And it was fascinating to us because they took us through this experiment that they did where they had boxers generate sweat while they were doing, boxing, so it was an aggressive action, and then they had sweat that was generated doing something that looked like boxing, but it was just a standard sort of exercise, so there was no aggression involved. Mm. And then they had volunteers who didn't know what they were sniffing smell the different types of sweat and see whether they could, through a complex test, see whether they could actually sense which sweat was the aggressive sweat and which was not. And what was fascinating is that over a large number of volunteers, the volunteers did react differently to the aggressive sweat. So the view was that we may have subliminated this, or if that's the correct word, that actual ability. It's not gone, and we still have this sort of unconscious almost ability to discover something that could actually protect us.
Mm-hmm. So we've only got about a minute left. I apologize. We didn't have quite as much time as I'd hoped. I talked too much earlier, so apologies to you. But I think the last minute, I think I'd like to point out, or give you an opportunity to point out, just the University of Leeds thing around the images.
Yes, so a fascinating thing. We all probably have experienced it, which is it possible that what we see affects what we feel? So once again, the multi-perceptionary thing, which is really the key finding for us of what's happened in the world of senses, that our senses don't operate on their own, they operate together. And in this case, we set up a fake lecture where the person started up just putting images up that were general images, and then they began to put up images of mosquitoes on people's skin and the things that that would cause you to feel itchy, and to see what kind of reaction we would get from the audience who didn't know that they were being filmed by us. And sure enough, as soon as those images came up of mosquitoes on skin or bees or those kind of things, that people in the audience began to scratch as if those animals were on their skin. And maybe it goes back to what you said before. It's really kind of a matter of safe, rather safe. So the body goes, okay, I see those things. I don't necessarily feel that on my skin, but I think I'll just check to make sure. And so the sense of touch is actually triggered by something that you see, which is absolutely fascinating. And it happens invariably, and they haven't exactly worked out why. But they do believe that part of the brain that deals with sight is also triggering the part of the brain that deals with touch.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank you very much again, Dougald Mosley, who's the filmmaker behind Myth or Science, The Secrets of Our Senses, which is going to be available on Nature of Things Thursday, January 26th at 8. If there's any time-shifting questions, we'll have a link to the website for that as well. People can check out if there's any variance in their local area. I'm not sure. But thank you so much for your time and for joining us.
Thank you, Darren.
All right. Pleasure. And that, as I was saying, that's all the time we have for today, unless you're listening to the podcast version, and then we'll be right back with the bonus show. Either way, thank you so much for listening. listening, and stay strong. Trump is being inaugurated right now if you're listening live. So you'll probably want to go download the bonus show. It's going to be funnier than what's on TV right now. Thanks so much for everybody for listening, and have a great week.